And here the music scene had more than one center. It felt multifaceted, like you might not meet every single person, which is an obvious fact in most cities, but not in small towns. I sensed a greater amount of drive and ambition in Portland that was still matched by many of the principles on which Slater-Kinney had been built and founded. We remained far from the music industry centers of LA or New York, still able to create from the margins, and people here valued community, innovation, and the retention of artistic credibility. Portland became a respite and a true hometown. Personally, as well as in Slater-Kinney, I have always relied heavily on resetting. I venture out and take risks, but then I need to return to steadiness and calm. Portland has a nurturing quality, a placidity. For better or worse, it's a perennial but shyly hopeful city. If we had a gesture, it would be a shrug. When I'd visit Portland in the 90s, it had a seedy quality to it. Just watch Gus Van Sant's Drugstore Cowboy if you want to get a fairly realistic picture of some of the locals. Like Seattle before the dot-com boom, Portland, and the Pacific Northwest in general, still felt like a place people came to disappear. You can hear that heaviness in the music from that era, the sadness in Nirvana, Mudhoney, Cracker Bash, the Wipers, who were from earlier years. The sounds embodied the emotional equivalent of getting washed up on a beach somewhere. You can feel at the mercy of your surroundings in the Northwest, subsisting on dreariness until even your internal landscape feels soggy. It's depressing, and before the money came in, before the buildings started to reflect the bright ideas and optimism, that sadness was reflected back much more poignantly. Writing songs after 9/11 felt treacherous. There wasn't much of a vocabulary other than fear and patriotism. Many people felt a growing anger and distrust toward the Bush-Cheney administration, yet public dissent or even questioning of the status quo was likened to treason. The Dixie Chicks' relatively mild comment admonishing George Bush while performing overseas would soon ignite vitriol, boycotts, and even death threats. Yet the political landscape wasn't the only thing fueling our songwriting or the element that defined the sound on our next record. For one, it was the first time in the history of the band that all three members lived in the same city. Rather than me commuting to Portland for a matter of hours, or Janet and Corin driving up to Olympia for the day, we could retain both a prolonged intensity to the writing sessions, but also work without the pressure of a time limit. In the past, if inspiration didn't strike, the next time we would all be together might be days or weeks away. But now we could take breaks when we got tired or stuck, or reconvene the next day. We had a new sense of continuity and momentum, ease and fluidity. And the short hiatus we had taken while Corin was pregnant instilled within us a need for Slater-Kinney. Janet lived off Hawthorne Boulevard, a street where hip met hippie, where vintage clothing and bead stores commingled. The front cover album photos for Dig Me Out were taken in her living room. We'd been practicing in the basement of her one-story bungalow since the Hot Rock days. The interior color scheme of the house was garish and bold, Pepto-Bismol pink in one room, Kelly Green in another, landscape and animal paintings hung on the wall. There were sleek pleather sofas and chairs and coffee table art books. These rooms were as familiar as those in my own house. Across the smudged and graying linoleum of the kitchen, down a few steps where Janet had old newspaper clippings from the Portland Trailblazers' one and only championship season stapled to the wall, past the washer-dryer, and finally, around a corner, was our practice space. It smelled of mold and cleaning supplies, dryer sheets and dust. Old carpeting and mattresses were affixed to the walls for soundproofing, along with a small chalkboard on which to write the song names. Now we stepped into it as if anew. The riffs Corin and I were bringing in were charred and bluesy. Corin had one we called Sympathy, partly as a nod to the Rolling Stones' Sympathy for the Devil. There had been an article in a local paper about a coyote hopping a ride on the light rail transit system, which we turned into a love song to Portland. Combat Rock was our version of a reggae song as done by The Clash, which of course was why we called it what we did. And we had a tune with a working title of One Beat, which characterized its drum part. We recorded One Beat at Jackpot Recording Studio's original location on Northeast Morrison Avenue, with Larry Crane as the engineer, and John Goodmanson again as producer. I've only cried once in the studio, and it was when Korn sang her vocals for Sympathy, a song about her fears of losing her son when he was born premature, the anxious, tender, and frightening days he spent in the NICU. Janet and I sat on the couch behind the mixing console and held our breath. Korn did the song in a single take. One Beat is often characterized as a political album, which speaks to how long it took for musicians, especially in the mainstream, to address or make sense of the xenophobia and jingoism that took hold of the culture post-9/11. One Beat was one of the earliest. Yet the common thematic thread on the record is less overtly political and more an exploration of faithlessness, of trying to uncover hope or meaning in a time that was very, very bleak. Certainly Far Away and Combat Rock addressed politics explicitly and deliberately, but the title track and Sympathy searched for meaning in scars, using pain and wounds as a vernacular. The album spoke to a dismantling of old ways, of old loves, of old ideas. We had stepped away from the band for only a moment, but realized soon enough that we wanted to pour everything we had back into it. Sleater-Kinney is never a group I could be in with any sense of passivity. There is a deliberate, almost unseen force to it. We wanted to be a sonic call to action, anthemic, to either join in or get out, to be shaken from indifference, not only the listeners, but ourselves. Before the album was released, we were asked to open for Belle and Sebastian at the Daughters of the American Revolution Hall in Washington, D.C. It is a beautiful theater, a far cry from the rock clubs and venues we were used to playing. Every once in a while, mostly at festivals stocked with bands with incessant four-on-the-floor kick drum patterns and choruses and arrangements graspable both immediately and from a mile away, I would be reminded of how abrasive our band could sound, how harsh we could appear in a feather-wearing, beach-ball-tossing, polite context. And really, there was no band who played more polite music than Belle and Sebastian. Knowing we had no way of winning over the delicate ears of their cardigan-wearing fans, we played our unreleased record, in its sequence and entirety, to the audience. None of our old songs would have likely been familiar anyway. In that ancient world of pre-cell phone camera codependency and social media addiction, no one captured the moment. One Beat was released in August 2002. We took a small and up-and-coming band from Akron called the Black Keys out on the road with us. It was unnerving to venture back into a world where we might again have a label or index or place before the term band. We had spent years attempting to exist free of excess and arbitrary labels that were not descriptions of our music. Female, indie, queer, Riot Girl, post-Riot Girl music. Now here we were with the potentiality of being a political band. But in the interim years, we'd realized that denial is its own form of compliance and self-erasure. Plus, it's exhausting. We would go out on the road and play these songs, and people could interpret them however the hell they wanted. Chapter 17. Opening Up. Some of the bands who opened for us went on to be huge. Yeah Yeah Yeahs, Gossip, The White Stripes, The Black Keys. No matter whether they would go on to blow up or break up or stay small, we wanted to tour with artists that we could stand to see night after night. Picking an opening band is an act of curation. You want there to be differentiation between the bands on the bill, but nothing too jarring, nothing that takes somebody out of the experience. And you don't want to be aggressively contrarian so that your audience isn't receptive to the openers, standing with crossed arms, counting down the minutes until you get on stage. It was always a very deliberate, considered decision for us. We wanted to expose our audience to new bands. Mostly, however, we wanted to feel challenged. We never wanted a band to play before us that wasn't capable of being a great live band, or that would make us seem bigger, louder, or tighter. We were confident enough to be matched, perhaps even usurped. The Black Keys had just put out their first album when we asked them to come on the road with us for the second leg of the One Beat tour. Dan and Patrick were mournful and gritty on stage, affable and Midwestern off. There was a lot of pool playing. In Detroit, hometown of the White Stripes, a particularly proud and loyal audience member with the intention of playing off a perceived rivalry, turned his back to the Black Keys for the entirety of their set, his middle finger raised defiantly in the air. You've got to appreciate a dedication analogous to the crazed affection towards sports teams, but disrespect is another matter altogether. Janet called the guy out during our show. We brought the Gossip along with us on their first ever tour, literally the first time they'd played outside of Olympia. The first show was at First Avenue in Minneapolis, a fairly large, well-established venue with a particularly high stage. I recall watching singer Beth Ditto own that stage within seconds of their set starting. They played exciting and unrelenting blues music at the time, suggestive, dancey, unabashedly Southern, queer, bold, and weird. Beth wasn't even 21 yet on that tour. I drove them around Chicago, showed them the shores of Lake Michigan. They crashed in our hotel rooms. I loved being witness as they saw the United States for the first time, these three young kids from Arkansas. They made us goofy and happy. We had dares almost every night of the tour. They painted our faces with ridiculous makeup. Janet was a marionette. I had freckles. Corin was a doll. We lost bets and had to give embarrassing shout-outs involving crushes in the middle of the set. At one point, there was a conga line on stage. The silliness was buoying. It staved off the tour tedium. The White Stripes were the band that really pushed the limits of what an opening band could do. You could still feel an electricity on the stage and in the air once they were done. It was in 2000, just a few months before they became one of the biggest bands around. It was the first time we brought a support act wherein you could tell some people in the audience were there just for them, that part of the audience didn't give a shit about us even though we were headlining. But even then, even when the opening band was testing and trying us, we still had to play our set and prove that it shouldn't have been the reverse. Later, when the White Stripes were huge, they asked us to open a few shows in order to repay the kindness, and we gladly did. Jack White remains gracious, generous, and one of my favorite performers. We always wanted to bring openers that raised our level of playing and performance. We were honored and excited to do it. When the White Stripes were on tour with us, we played a show at Oberlin College in Ohio. The gig was in the Student Center, the kind of place where someone can order a slice of pizza only a few feet from stage, and if you're not playing loud enough, you might even hear the customer's name being called over the intercom. Backstage, Jack would entertain us with Loretta Lynn or Sunhouse songs on guitar. He was a showman, always on, a peacock, but his prancing was never uninvited or unwanted. He always had a presence, a way of reaching the farthest corners of a room, that star quality of simultaneously sucking the air out of a space and giving it life. On this particular night, we were confronted by the classic tour scenario, the promise of an after-party. It usually entails an intrepid kid approaching you and telling you about the event, how awesome it is going to be. He gives you his phone number or slips you an address on a piece of paper, which you often lose either on purpose or by accident. But this night we thought we'd give it a try. Often in small towns you feel slightly off the radar. This instills in you a sense of wildness and freedom. You feel inconspicuous. The vibe is casual. You're much more likely to end up hanging out with fans at a local bar in Lawrence, Kansas or Omaha than in New York or L.A. Corin was pregnant on this tour, so she wasn't always up for after-show revelry or really for anything other than crashing out. So we rode with White Stripes to the address we were given. We walked up to the house, and immediately two guys walked down the stairs and greeted us at the door. "Who are you?" they asked accusingly. They obviously hadn't been at our show. You'd think at Oberlin, a bastion of liberal arts education and hipness, a breeding ground for creative types spewing expression, often for the sake of expression, that everyone would greet the bands that had just entertained their friends with open arms. We weren't expecting the Keys to the city, okay, town, but at the very least we thought we could count on a knowing nod, a thumbs up, and all the free alcohol we wanted. This wasn't cotillion or prom or graduation that we were crashing. This was a party taking place in a wall-to-wall carpeted duplex with particle board cabinets. Don't people want to hang with musicians? Yet band life is full of humbling moments such as these. It was an outright rejection. We were told that the party was full, as if there were a legal capacity to which they were adhering and only so many rubbery vegan hot dogs and red Solo cups to go around. I often think back on those two guys who turned us away, wondering if they know they kicked Jack White out of their party. If they saw him later on TV or in a magazine and thought he looked familiar, if he reminded them of the tall guy who stood helplessly on their front lawn and then walked back to an outdated, beat-up van. To me, it's the perfect distillation of the disparity between being on stage and being off. For all the power you command in a live context, all the myth and myth-making that goes into that moment, elevated by the agreement between performer and audience, when you're off stage, you're shrunk down to human size, to the humility it takes to endure the quotidian. In 2000, Greil Marcus named us the best rock band in America in Time magazine. The next morning on a talk show, Bryant Gumbel waved the magazine and asked incredulously, "Who is this band?" It felt unreal. We'd never had a radio hit or sold any amount of albums nearing the status of gold or platinum. In the larger scheme of things, population-wise, hardly anyone had heard of us, least of all the subscribers of Time. We had taken the accompanying photos for the article while on tour. It all had to happen immediately, so they hastily set up a shoot all the way in Scotland. When we flew home a few weeks later, the magazine issue had just come out. Here we were, America's best rock band, unloading our equipment that had been shipped home from overseas, that we'd just picked up from the airport by ourselves. Drums, amps, road cases. We did not even have the help of a friend or crew member to carry everything out of our van and into Janet's basement, down rotted steps with very low headroom. You had to duck or you'd give yourself a concussion. Best band in America, and my back is about to go out again because I'm carrying a 60-pound amp into a practice space the size of a pantry in which Janet's aged marmalade cat had sprayed multiple times. It smelled like piss and dryer sheets. This was us having made it. We never stopped working. Most bands don't. There is very little about being a working musician that is glamorous, which is why I have never understood people who get on stage and hardly even try. What else is there besides that moment? Why would you waste it? In the 90s, the term slacker was applied to a certain kind of breezy, laid-back male artist. Beck, Stephen Malcolmus of Pavement, Rivers Cuomo of Weezer. These guys were understated, sneaker-wearing. They acted like they couldn't be bothered and had a tossed-off coolness. Lyrics seemed to pour out of their mouths in profound, poetic drips. They made it look casual, like the stakes were low or non-existent. I admired and listened to the music, and I think their perception and reception were different from their intent. But I also thought about what a privilege it must be to feel or to affect that entitlement, to be on stage, to play music, to get up in front of people and appear not to care. Recently, I saw a band play on Saturday Night Live. It's mostly one guy, but he tours with 9 or more people, all of them men. Every one of them wore T-shirts. If a group of 9 women wore T-shirts on a national TV show, people would, 1, ridicule them for not trying to look pretty, or 2, think it was an art project. At the very least, it would be notable. Though the term slacker music, not one that these musicians put upon themselves, I should stress, has since disappeared, certainly the affectlessness remains, the gutlessness, in many bands and artists that have come since. Entitlement is a precarious place from which to create or perform. It projects the idea that you have nothing to prove, nothing to claim, nothing to show but self-satisfaction, a smug boredom. It breeds ambivalence. It's as if instead of having to prove they are something, these musicians prove they aren't anything. It's an inverted dynamic, one that sets performers up to fail, but also gives them a false sense of having already arrived. I don't understand how someone would not push, challenge, or at least be present, how anyone could get on stage and not give everything. Slater-Kinney had to prove ourselves all over again when we returned to the opening slot in 2003. By then, we'd become accustomed to headlining most of our own shows, but Pearl Jam invited us to join them on tour. Eddie Vedder had always been kind towards Sleater-Kinney. I met him at one of our shows in Seattle in 1998, outside the Crocodile Cafe. Eddie walked up and stood in line behind me and Corin. He introduced himself to us and said he felt like he was standing next to Jagger and Richards. It's a compliment a girl doesn't hear too often. When the invite came, we didn't hesitate. Bob Lawton knew that exposing our band to a bigger audience that would never know us otherwise was crucial. We felt like Pearl Jam was the right band to do that with. The financial offer was generous, the timing was right, and they were good people, like-minded Northwesterners. Our first show with Pearl Jam was in Denver on April Fool's Day. We'd been playing the fist-raising call-to-arms songs off One Beat on our own tours in clubs and theaters around the world, but now we would perform in sports stadiums and arenas. Without giving it a second thought, Corn criticized George W. Bush from the stage. It was almost the first thing she said to a crowd of over 15,000 at the Pepsi Center, people who had little or no idea who we were. To fans in the nosebleed section, we probably looked like ants, which was also how significant we were to most of these Pearl Jam listeners. Calling out George W. for his warmongering was something our crowd would have practically expected from us. By April 2003, support for the dual wars in Iraq and Afghanistan was starting to dwindle, especially in the more left-leaning urban centers and cities. And one area where support for our then-president was securely and almost universally out of favor was in the politically homogenous indie rock and alternative music circles. Sleater-Kinney probably could have burned Bush in effigy or torn apart a life-size replica of him at the end of our sets, and the crowds would have cheered, taking home destroyed doll remnants as souvenirs. Pearl Jam, it turned out, played music to all kinds of people. Their fans were both rural and urban, Republicans and Democrats, and everything in between. The band was touring with their album, Riot Act, which featured an excoriating song called Bushleaguer. In Denver, the song, or perhaps it was the George W. Bush rubber mask that Eddie pulled on, drew boos from the crowd. Yet 5 minutes later, that same sports cap-wearing man with upper arm hair and a cross around his neck who had booed Eddie would be tearing up, enacting a human seatbelt on his eyelinered girlfriend and singing along to Black. Here was the mainstream. We had a lot to learn. When you've only been on van tours, we wouldn't tour in a bus until the woods. Pulling up to a venue where professional sports teams play is humbling and intimidating. When we arrived to soundcheck in our 15-passenger Ford Econoline, it looked like we should be showing up to restock napkins at a concession stand or refill a vending machine. And just at one stand or one machine, otherwise we would be driving a semi-truck. Everything around us was bigger and more formidable than our vehicle. The insignificance was acute. Pearl Jam had multiple buses and semis, a private plane, a lighting rig, countless racks of gear, a mixing and monitor console, a separate recording facility and mixing board for documenting each show, a chef, a personal trainer, guitar and drum techs, and a general crew of over 40 people. Our three-person crew would load our two amps and one drum kit onto a stage the size of the entire venues we'd been playing up until that point. We set up our gear in front of a wall of beautiful vintage amps, high-tech gear, drum, and piano risers. Each member of Pearl Jam came with not simply his own equipment, but his own section, his own world. From up there on the stage, it resembled consecutive dorm rooms, each guy's area affixed with personal touches and mementos. It was exciting and grand, larger than life. Though I had no reservations about touring with Pearl Jam, elitism was a stubborn habit to kick. A small part of my brain retreated to my younger self, reminding me that in certain circles, Nirvana had been considered the cooler, more authentic band. Nirvana's music dragged you across the floor. You felt every crack, every speck of dirt. Their songs helped you locate the places where you ached, and in that awareness of your hurting, you suddenly knew that the bleakness was collective, not merely your own. In other words, it's okay to feel like a freak. And in high school, and for much of my adult life, maybe even now, I had. I do. So I'll be honest. I wondered whether I could like Pearl Jam's music, not just the hits I knew might stoke my high school nostalgia, but the entirety of the band, their sound, their thing. Their songs had solos, multiple solos. They had ballads to take the room down a bit and anthems to bring the room back up. They possessed a mastery in a genre in which I had become accustomed to scoffing at mastery as an automatic equivalent to or indication of quality. Also, they seemed normal. And bubbling up from the formative years that shaped my relationship to outsider art, which I loved and related to, I still held onto my skepticism of normality. The greater mental hurdle was whether we wanted to or were capable of playing in front of the Pearl Jam audience. For as sweet as those guys were, their audience felt alien. It was mainstream, for one, and perhaps not ready or willing to make sense of three women making a racket, with no bass, very few solos, and an angularity not easily digestible. But we felt it was an opportunity we shouldn't pass up. It would be a challenge, and we had not been an opening band for a long time. Any leftover snobbery about Pearl Jam changed after the first show. No matter how much crew a band or musician takes on tour, whether they travel in relative luxury or squalor, whether someone else tunes their guitar for them or switches pedal settings from the side of the stage, the bottom line is, at some point, it's just people on stage playing music, doing a job. And for the best of these performers, among whom I count Eddie Vedder, there is no holding back, no wasted moment. What I discovered was that Pearl Jam's music was soaring. Vedder's lyrics spoke to pain and anger, but offered a way out. There was hopefulness to them. They came from a singer who wanted to live, to be alive. By the end of the tour, Slater Kinney was joining Pearl Jam on stage for the encore, singing and playing along to Neil Young's Rockin' in the Free World and Harvest Moon. The band shared the experience, made it about us and about their fans. Vedder felt a true kinship with me and with my band. He was a punk and agitator who had ended up in one of the world's most popular groups, and each night he managed to relay tremendous generosity and openness. At the end of the first and longest tour we would do with them, he gave me his custom Gibson SG Special. I play it to this day. I love being a new onlooker, a convert. To become a fan of something, to open and change, is a move of deliberate optimism, curiosity, and enthusiasm. Touring with Pearl Jam allowed me to see how diminishing and stifling it is to close yourself off to experiences. It was a tour that changed my life. It turns out that if we hadn't toured with Pearl Jam, we probably would not have made the woods. We walked on stage each night with the stakes high, which is a hard place to return to for a band that's been around for nearly a decade. But we were unknown here. We felt brand new, untested, unloved. It forced us to turn inward, to focus on why we played and how we played. We had to listen to one another, to count on one another as the source of joy and givers of the only rewards. We had to find intrinsic value in what we were doing, to not rely on the audience to compensate for any of our own lack of energy or drive or desire. And certainly there were Pearl Jam fans who liked us, who walked back from getting their hot dogs and beer, and who eventually looked up from their conversations to watch a song or two. I waited for those moments each night. The daylight was fading. It felt like the real concert was happening after us. But we had to make it real each night, to bring to what was so clearly not the main event an intensity that would raise the audience's eyes to us. Without the help of lights or cheers, we inserted ourselves into the landscape, and a few people took notice. By the time we finished, there would be people standing, watching, listening. Since few of them knew our songs, we had no one to please, and we started jamming at the end of the sets, just for ourselves, partly to get people's attention, to make something so long and drawn out as to foment discomfort, to defy expectations, and partly to surprise ourselves as much as them, to keep it interesting for us. And in deconstructing our own songs, we found that we were building something anew. a trust in what we were as a band and what we could still become. Chapter 18, The Woods. Opening for Pearl Jam enabled and emboldened us, and it instilled in us a desire to write songs that had improvisational moments built in. So on The Woods, there are moments that break apart, disintegrate, allow the opportunity to rebuild. Instead of approaching a song as something small, we started big, and we carved smallness and detail out of a broader canvas. I don't know if we could have envisioned that broadness if we hadn't played on a big stage, heard our sound echo around an amphitheater. And that's how we got from one beat to The Woods. It's what made us a better live band and reminded us that it could feel uncertain. And that sense of uncertainty was how we were going to create something better. Sleater-Kinney was nearing the decade mark of being a band. It felt like we knew our capabilities, that they were approaching something finite and fixed. And our audience knew what we were capable of, what we were going to sound like, who our label was. The people who didn't like us would continue not to like us, and the people who liked us would feel the same, ad infinitum. I could imagine that the journalists had already written their reviews, like the obituaries on deck for the nearly dead. Someone could just plug in the name of our latest album, and the review would be done. I didn't want to be the Mr. Rogers of music, where we could open a closet and see the same 10 sweaters, and everyone would know what we were going to wear, since there was a predetermined set of choices. None of us were that excited about that anymore. I don't want to know what's going to happen. As frightening as that is in real life, it's a crucial aspect in creativity. Being predictable is boring, and it's also disheartening and uninspiring. We needed a sense of rediscovery for the audience and for ourselves. We had always recorded in Portland or Seattle, places that were or felt like home, and we'd recorded with someone we'd known for years who was part of our community. We were still working with the label we had worked with basically from the beginning. With The Woods, we pulled the rug out from beneath ourselves, a potentially self-sabotaging risk. But changes had also happened unwittingly. We were already one foot out the door, dangling. Bob Lawton, our longtime booking agent and one of our most consistent and loyal team members, decided to retire. And Julie Butterfield, who had been our PR person, our manager, a source of reason and guidance, and a close friend throughout all of the band's history, had also decided to embark on something different. Two of our pillars were knocked out already. So, when we thought about Kill Rock Stars, our label and a group of people we loved, we realized that maybe we should take all the known factors and comforts away and start over as much as we could. You can't really be reborn, but we wanted to create an ersatz beginning. We started looking for a new label and landed with Sub Pop. We got a new booking agent. We hired a producer we'd never worked with before. We cobbled together a whole new existence for ourselves. From a songwriting perspective, it was invigorating, but on a personal level, it was stressful for each of us. Our songwriting process had changed. For a while, I thought academia was pulling me in a different direction from the band, and in the fall of 2003, I moved to Berkeley for a relationship and to test out the potential of attending graduate school. Ever since those early days of Sleater-Kinney playing shows at Bryn Mawr or Wesleyan, I'd imagined a different kind of life for myself, a quieter life, one I thought to have more consistency and normalcy. Yet here I was, practicing a more domestic self in a sunny Berkeley bungalow, and I felt fitful and dissatisfied. I applied to two low-residency MFA programs in nonfiction and was accepted to both. But as I spent time around academics in the Bay Area, my desire to be in that world faded. With music, I had been working in a populist medium, whereas academia felt insular and impenetrable. I wanted my work to be found, discovered, available, and I was fooling myself thinking that I could or would give up the one thing, music, that although peripatetic and jolting and full of vicissitudes, had also brought me the most joy, the most highs, the most connection I had ever felt. Over those 6 months in California, with Portland in the rearview mirror and the band something I could examine with some distance, I realized my yearning had little to do with place and more with the fact that I continually made a ritual of emptiness. No matter where I was or what I was doing, I would always feel a certain deficit. Like before, as a way to fill the hole, I began writing songs. Music began to restore me again. Living in California informed many of my lyrics on the woods. While there, I read a Tad Friend article in The New Yorker about suicides on the Golden Gate Bridge. I wrote the song Jumpers about this piece. I read it as I was taking BART into the city, and I found myself crying and thinking about how out of place I felt. I had never lived outside the Pacific Northwest before, and I couldn't understand why, in this place of such intense beauty and sun, and where I assumed I'd find those things invigorating, I felt a sharp, alienating contrast. I related to the feeling of not being able to find meaning in your life, so that you try to find a way of instilling meaning in your death, looking for a way for it to somehow be symbolic or beautiful or publicly acknowledged. The Golden Gate Bridge is a structure that is extraordinarily solid in terms of engineering prowess, but unstable in that it's a launching place for those in despair. I wanted to write about the instability of structures, whether they're internal structures that we thought were holding us together, or political structures that we thought were stable or safe, that we could rely on for doing good. I felt a weakening in the foundation. I guess I didn't know that foundation might be the band itself, that things I thought I could count on were starting to dismantle. I returned to Portland and the band with an almost desperate relief. I bought the house I still live in, latching on to my own small square of the city with a sense of new permanence. Janet and Corin and I could once again write on a regular basis instead of on my limited bi-monthly commutes. Writing for the woods marked another shift. Less often did Corin or I bring in parts of a song or an entire song. Now Janet and I were doing a lot more of the songwriting, while Corin was busy with family. We had to push her, and she was reluctant to be pushed. Slater Kinney were making our scariest record, and Corin was a mother with a young kid. It was natural that in that realm, in parenthood, she wanted to ward off and protect her kin from horrors, to bring light and happiness into her world. Yet Janet and I were really embracing harshness and leaning into something sonically and thematically dark. We felt there was a creeping tepidness in music, a cloying softness, as if music were only a salve, not an instigator. It's not that we didn't listen to or appreciate pretty songs, or that music couldn't merely be for entertainment. I can listen to soft songs, but I can't play them. Even Slater Kinney's lighter songs feel thorny or brittle. They aren't gentle, and they make horrible background music. Janet and I wanted this record to have teeth. Corin didn't quite feel the same intensity at this point. There was tension. When Corin finally got there, especially vocally, she went way out there, but I feel like we shoved her. On the chorus of Let's Call It Love, she sounds mad and desperate, longing and lost. We tossed her out into the ether, and you can hear her singing her way back. The notes are carrying her, but it's not pretty. It's the sound of someone fighting against herself and against her doubters, who in that moment happened to be in her own band. I think the woods turned out exactly how we wanted it, but the process was very painful. Janet was the one who found and reached out to Dave Fridman. At the time, he was mainly known for his work with the Flaming Lips. Dave only works in one studio, which is in Casadega, New York. Initially, we thought it sounded glamorous to record in New York, and I imagined weekend trips to the city. In actuality, Casadega is tucked away in the far western part of the state, near Buffalo, more than 8 hours from New York City. Plus, we were recording in the depths of winter and were snowed in most of the time. We stayed at the house attached to the recording studio, where we felt isolated, entrenched in a wholly immersive and insular experience. We didn't have the luxury, at the end of the day, of returning to our regular world, to our friends and relationships and animals and families. The intensity never let up. We ate and slept and breathed the music. While one of us was cooking, the others would continue working, then we'd all eat together. After a full day of recording, we'd go up to our rooms and watch movies or TV shows until 4 a.m. We watched music documentaries and burned through Freaks and Geeks. We played Led Zeppelin records and read. We were too wired and rarely slept. In the mornings, we take walks in the woods with sticks to protect ourselves from the under-socialized, overly protective country dogs, and we'd wear orange vests on account of hunting season. Then it would snow again, and we would sled down the hill, careening and careless, mostly ending up in ditches. The neighbor boys came over and let us fire their shotguns at bottles, or took us out on their ATVs. It felt like good, clean fun, in such contrast to what we were unleashing in the studio, which felt raw and messy. Dave told us to let him produce and have a say on this record, or we shouldn't work with him at all. It was a scary prospect. We were accustomed to having total control. John Goodmanson was always wary of overstepping, of intruding too heavily on our process. But we were willing. When we first arrived in Casadega, Dave sat in the room with a notepad while we played the songs for him. He would question why a certain song part needed to be there, and we either had to justify the structure or reasoning or change it. It was an intimidating but important process. On What's Mine Is Yours, which abruptly changes in the middle of the song, it was Dave's idea to have it completely fall apart. Originally, the song went from the second chorus into a bridge, but his thought was that if we wanted a change, it should be noticeable. He said, "Why doesn't everyone just stop playing and see what happens?" And that's how we got a sudden, long, weird guitar solo in the middle of the song. One of us had to come in, otherwise there was just silence. So I played until everyone else found their way back into the song. Fridman created a lot of ledges for us to jump off. His way of describing what he wanted to hear was very visual and textural. He told Janet, "I need you to sound like Keith Moon, but like I'm lowering a blanket over Keith Moon." We trusted him right away, and when we heard ourselves back after the first takes, we knew we had found the right person. I suppose many of our longtime listeners were upset because we were taking perfectly normal songs and making them hard to listen to. The sound was blown out and grating. We wanted to make something fractious. We didn't want to please or appease. Perhaps that sounds arrogant or even callous, but we recoiled at the common tacit expectation that the more records you make, the more they'll start to feel cozy, settled in, mellowed out. Daddy rock, mommy rock, lullabies, as if once we're no longer in our 20s, we're just supposed to soothe ourselves to sleep every night. We were more prone to insomnia, at our most awake in the dark. The very first show for the Woods tour felt inauspicious. We played the Moore Theater in Seattle. I wore a typically bizarre polyester shirt with a large bow, buttoned too tight and high up on the neck to be conducive to performing. That business casual vibe is hard to quit. It was another one of those sartorial choices, like a cowboy hat or faux fur jacket, to be categorized in the bad tour purchase column. After the show, we were backstage celebrating with Sub Pop, whose employees had all come to the show in their hometown. I could feel my neck getting hot. At first I thought it was the shirt, but then came the familiar feeling of my ears swelling and closing. I was breaking out in hives. My breathing grew tight. I left the festivities. My dad and a friend of mine took me to the emergency room, where I stayed until nearly 4 a.m., amped up on steroids for the swelling, which were in direct competition with the Benadryl I had taken prior. I woke up in my father's guest room, groggy, with puffy eyes. We had a show to play in Portland that night. Our big hometown show to debut the new record was at the Crystal Ballroom, a large venue downtown. A few minutes before I had to head to soundcheck, I walked into my bathroom and looked at myself in the mirror. My eyes were still swollen from the allergic reaction the night before. The hives had diminished, but my skin looked mottled. My face was its own Halloween mask. Then I couldn't breathe. I was outside myself looking in. I was on the wall of the bathroom. I was outside my house, a satellite. I could feel my smallness. When my chest constricted, it was not on account of my rib cage, but of the universe enveloping me and folding me into its vastness. It's nothingness. I called Corin to tell her that I was having chest pains and that I'd be missing soundcheck. I drove myself to a hospital in northwest Portland. They hooked me up to an EKG machine, which of course determined that I wasn't having a heart attack, that physically I was fine. It only proved that perhaps my brain wasn't. It was a panic attack, possibly exacerbated by the steroids, which I need to stay on for a few more days. My body wanted me to take it easy, but in some ways we were already taking it incredibly easy. After Corin had her son, Marshall, our touring became less intense. Her responsibility to Marshall and her desire to spend more time at home and less time on the road reshaped our schedule. The first leg of the tour for the woods would only be a month long. We took care of ourselves. We didn't smoke or do any drugs. We barely drank. We did do a lot of the work by ourselves. We still helped load our own gear, designed our own t-shirts, consulted on and approved PR and marketing strategies. But this tour, we'd get to take a bus, so for the first time, we wouldn't literally be driving ourselves to the shows. I'm not complaining. A band is a small business, and we liked being hands-on, part of the decision-making process. We liked being in control. It's no wonder that many artists deal with tour by desensitizing themselves until the moment they are on stage. Tour is a precarious nexus between monotony and monomania, a day of nothingness followed by a moment that feels like everything. You deal with tour by reading, walking, watching TV or movies, zoning out online. If you're lucky, you engage in an activity that posits you in a specific place, a museum, a visit with a friend, a local restaurant. But most of the day feels shapeless, a blurriness that comes into focus only once you soundcheck and begin the progression toward the show itself. Even the day's most mundane activities, eating, drinking coffee, working out in the hotel gym, doing a phone interview with a weekly paper for an upcoming show, all of these things carry with them a sense of validation and productivity because they are couched within the sphere of tour. But in actuality, it is aimless. If it's not already numbing, you find a way to get numb. Even missing someone or something is dangerous because it takes you out of tour. When I moved back to Portland to write The Woods, I wanted to find a way of tethering myself to a place, to home, and so I adopted a dog. Up until that point, I had few domestic responsibilities, save for my two cats, that I could take on or be competent in. If you're in a band, you're surrounded by few demarcations of maturity in the traditional sense, because you're perennially enacting fairly adolescent behavior. It's an unconventional life. Of course, some people get married and have children, but just as many people in that world don't. A music career, especially for a woman, is so at odds with the assumed normative path toward maturity and aging. Toby was a wire-haired pointer mix with a challenging combination of intelligence and wild energy. At first, I was obsessive. This was a whole new skill set to learn. I dove into training, research, problem-solving. Toby provided a certain level of distraction that I really liked. He was impossible and stubborn and adorable. Janet got a dog, too, and we would take them on the short legs of tours. I loved the sense of companionship, though I had moments of panic, too. This was something I really had to commit to, this dog. Leaving Toby made it harder to tour because he became a reminder of how much I was away. The rest of the U.S. tour I made it through without medical incident. Our final show was in Denver. We were playing the last song of the regular set, Entertain, when my palms began to itch. This was not a mild sensation, but an incessant, unignorable nuisance. I would scratch furiously and then strum at my guitar. The itchiness was a bizarre intrusion of bodily reality into an experience that usually obliviates the quotidian. By then, Entertain was a song that we elongated with an improvised jam, stretching out our enjoyment of the set and of the crowd. But on this night, I couldn't think of anything other than the hives. I could tell one of my eyes was swelling shut, and I mouthed to Corin, allergic reaction. We abruptly finished the song, and our tour manager drove me to the nearest hospital. The reaction was 10 times worse than it had been in Seattle. The doctors gave me 2 shots of adrenaline to prevent me from going into anaphylactic shock. Both eyes swelled shut. Instead of toasting to a successful tour and hanging out with our crew, Janet and Corin drove to the hospital. We spent the last night of tour sitting around my hospital bed. When I got home, I saw a specialist who determined that I had a food allergy. Looking back, I realized that each incident of hives had been preceded by the consumption of soy. The doctor called it exercise-induced anaphylaxis. Instead of having a normal reaction, the sweat and increased heart rate expedites the speed with which the allergen courses through the body, making it potentially life-threatening. But also, allergies? Hives? These are not the afflictions of rock bands or guitarists. Hives doesn't really have the same ring to it as, say, heroin, and it falls far short of legendary potential. Nor are there any memorable songs about allergies, at least unsung for adults. With allergies, you don't get to venture into the euphemism exhaustion like you do if you lose your mind, throw a fit, punch someone in the face, go on a racist social media rant, or get arrested. Nope, I was sane, high-functioning, a little on the anxious and depressive side, and now saddled with an affliction that would garner me more sympathy at a natural grocer or with the PTA than with music journalists or fans. Not necessarily fodder for behind the music. Next up to promote the Woods was a European tour that would begin in the UK. England in particular had long been fairly indifferent toward Sleater-Kinney, but for some reason they were enamored of the Woods. The British press love when American bands play at Americanness, the same way the U.S. eats up the Brits playing at being Brits. It is a satisfying cycle of self-validation, a country imagined by outsiders. And I suppose the Woods was our own scrappy version of a national anthem, of a frontier, jagged and belted through a crackling megaphone. We were excited to finally be met with more than just a mild enthusiasm overseas. Our first show was at All Tomorrow's Parties, a weekend festival we co-curated with the Shins and Dinosaur Jr. 2 days before we flew out, I felt a sharp pain in my side. The more hypochondriacal part of me momentarily feared appendicitis, but I chalked it up to the typical pre-tour anxiety and set forth with all of the enthusiasm and eagerness I could muster. ATP is held in the south of England at a resort called Pontins. The American equivalent of this facility would be like staying at a Super 8 motel still decorated for Easter 3 months past the holiday and featuring a rain-soaked, outdated McDonald's play area partially closed for construction. Here, the pain in my side bloomed into a small rash. Yet much of tour is about ignoring the body instead of listening to it, so we continued on to France. By now, instead of the rash spreading or dissipating, it had become a series of perfectly round blisters. They were painful, but the surface area they covered was small. I convinced myself that it was from my guitar, the combined result of sweat and chafing, even though nothing of the sort had ever previously occurred. In addition, and to feel like I was being proactive, I purchased a cream at a pharmacy, since cream seemed like the least intrusive and most readily available solution. On we went to Germany. By now I was walking around in a state of anxiety. I would fall in and out of panic attacks. The feeling of breathlessness and choking was intermittent, bordering on constant. More disconcerting was the feeling of unreality, similar to what I'd experienced in the bathroom mirror before the show in Portland at the beginning of the Woods tour. I felt separate from my body, a tingling in my limbs like a slow vanishing. After our show in Berlin, with the symptoms and the unease now impossible to ignore, Janet and I took a taxi to a hospital in the eastern part of the city. We arrived at a series of austere, windowless structures. They had an eerie architectural sternness, a building crossing its arms. In the waiting room, a young man sat with a bloody urine sample in his lap. The act of sitting, of waiting, despite being in a foreign country, despite not even really knowing what was wrong with me, was strangely familiar and comforting. This was consistency. Being sick had become my remedy for tour. Finally, I was escorted down a dimly lit hallway to a small room with an impossibly high exam table. I sat in an adjoining chair and waited. A doctor came in and looked at my stomach. He spoke very little English, and I spoke no German. He left the room and returned with a book. He opened to a page with a series of pictures. I felt like he was a tourist trying to order at a restaurant, using one of those pictorial guidebooks that allow you to have little grasp of the language, but to nevertheless explain your needs by pointing at what you want. What this doctor wanted was to show me what exactly was ailing me. So he pointed at a close-up photograph of a rash that looked like mine. Written below the photo was the word, first in German, but then in an array of letters that I understood. Shingles. He gave me a prescription for antiviral meds and pain pills, and I was off into the night. We stopped at a 24-hour pharmacy and went back to the hotel. The next morning, we met in the lobby to set off for our next shows. Embarrassed, I let the crew know about the shingles. There was talk about whether to cancel the tour, but I was convinced that we shouldn't. There were only about 2 more weeks left. Shingles, in case you're under the age of 65 or have never been ridden with stress-induced illness, is a recurrence of the chickenpox virus, which lies dormant in your body. Painful blisters form along nerve endings, usually only manifesting themselves on one side of the body. Shingles is quite contagious, especially before the blisters have fully scabbed over, though you can't give someone shingles. You can, however, give chickenpox to someone who has never had it, and what I swiftly found out was that Janet had never had chickenpox. I felt like a walking infection, zombified and pestiferous. Tours' insularity can be what makes it wonderful and magical and sort of like summer camp, but that same insularity coupled with an infectious illness is more a horror film. If we could have found humor in the situation, it would have made for an amazing parody, but there was very little laughter at this point. We were driving around Europe in our van, with a limited amount of air circulating through a cramped space. I was very conscious of trying not to expose Janet to the shingles, and she obviously didn't want to be anywhere near me. I kept my headphones on and stared at my computer. More than the virus, a sense of disappointment filled the air. By the time we'd reached Brussels, my body felt like a bag my brain was carrying with me. Heavy, the weight unevenly distributed, the contents mashed and scrambled. I felt raw and scraped, like a human crayon, dragging myself across surfaces, leaving a foamy smudge. The show in Brussels was at La Botanique, a greenhouse-like structure, glass and octagonal, with an abundant echo both of history and of the voices and footsteps of the present day. It was grand, superb. I was a sick speck. Janet was on the phone with one of her sisters, a doctor, who explained the airborne nature of shingles. I was contagious, unleashed, and on the loose. I felt nothing but exhaustion, guilt, and shame. That's when Corin helped me with my shirt. She was delicate on account of my own discomfort, but also hers. Here she was mothering me, missing her own kid back at home. This could hardly be worth it, I thought, for her, for me. It was time for us to play, but I for once couldn't access any reserves. I felt like mush, murky. I was an outsider and outside, undone and unraveled. I started to cry. It was that ugly kind of sadness, of wailing, where your face distorts, lips curl, your features cascade like a waterfall. And then, whack! I punched myself in the face. Over and over, I repeated the motion. Each blow brought the feeling to the surface. The hatred rose up, and I hit it back down. I saw the enemy, and it was me. I wanted to destroy it. Pow! I couldn't stop. Thud! You fucking fraud! I was in the ring with only myself. Here's your fear. Punch! Here's your anger. Here's every sickness you've ever known. Slap! Here's your powerlessness. Smack! I boxed myself to oblivion. I was going to make myself extinct. Janet and Corin were standing in front of me now. They were yelling at me to stop, and they were horrified. I knew that. I could sense their pity, fear, resignation. My hands were their voices and their judgment, their disappointment, but mostly my own. I was a child throwing a tantrum, but I wasn't an infant. I was 32 years old and one-third of a band that relied on me every single day and night. One-third of a partnership wherein the other two people depended on me for their livelihood. Each hit was the end. The end. We were past the end. In a matter of minutes, Slater-Kinney was gone. I had knocked its lights out. TKO. We would play the next show,